Hello, and welcome to What Comes to Mind, Season 2 of The Psychonaut Show. This is John K. Burton, MD, psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and your host on this podcast that brings ideas from the history of psychoanalysis to solve problems in everyday life. In this episode, we're going to explore the concept of narcissism. Now, you probably think I'm going to be talking about Donald Trump again, because we talk about Donald Trump from time to time on the Psychonaut Show.
Nobody knows the system better than me, which is why I alone can fix it.
There's been a lot of controversy in the mental health field and in public about whether we can diagnose him or not, whether, as some people think, we should warn people that he's a narcissist. But why does this even come up? Because he talks a lot about himself.
Everybody knows me.
But then, so do some of our other presidents and presidential candidates. What about Hillary Clinton? She talked a lot about herself, too.
I won the places that represent...
And so did Bill Clinton.
You don't have any example where I ever lied to the American people about my job, where I ever let the American people down.
And remember George Bush saying, I'm the decider,
and I decide what is best and what's...
when people challenged his authority. And some people even think Bernie Sanders is a narcissist.
This great nation belongs to all of us.
Which, as someone who grew up in Vermont, confuses me a great deal. But still, it's out there. And, of course, people who want to be president, who are leaders, are going to have a lot of confidence. And that's not what we're talking about when we talk about narcissism. So no, this isn't about Donald Trump, but instead we're going to ask, what do we even mean when we're talking about narcissism? Now, it is helpful to have an example that we all know about to think of as a starting point. And a lot of analysts think that the sitcom Seinfeld is the best example of narcissism, since each character seems to represent a different type of narcissist. But these analysts obviously haven't seen another sitcom from the 90s, Absolutely Fabulous. Rolling down the road. I've seen every episode probably at least 15 times. And in season 2, episode 2, Death, it is the best portrayal of narcissism that I can think of in pop culture. In it, we see Eddie's reaction to her father's death.
Well, I suppose it had to hit me sooner or later, darling, didn't it?
Yes.
I mean, she died. It sort of made me think, you know.
Good.
I don't want to die!
So, as we will see, death and dying are the ultimate terrors of the narcissist. Before we get into a couple of real-life cases that show us about narcissism, I want to go back to the myth of Narcissus. Psychoanalysts love myths. Of course, Oedipus is the big one, and the idea is that they come right to us from the unconscious. So I did a little research on the myth of Narcissus, which we remember as the beautiful young man who saw his reflection in some water and stopped to stare at it, and eventually was turned into a flower that we know now by the name of Narcissus. But it turns out there's a few different versions of the story. There's a Greek version where a man by the name of Ammonius, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but he fell in love with Narcissus, and Narcissus spurned him and sent him a sword and told him to commit suicide. And Ammonius decided he would go ahead and commit suicide, but before he did, he asked the goddess Nemesis, the goddess of vengeance, who is a dark aspect of Artemis, the goddess of the hunt and the moon, to curse Narcissus for spurning him. And she did. She's the one that caused him to see his reflection and fall in love with it as a punishment for being unable to love others. In the Roman version that comes to us from Ovid, we find the Greek oracle again, the Greek oracle phenomenon that I've talked about before, in this case coming up in the figure of the blind seer Tiresias, who's also in Oedipus, by the way. And he told Narcissus's, I'm not sure if we can say that, Narcissus's parents, who were, by the way, a river god and a nymph, that he would live a long life if he didn't know himself, being typically opaque like a Greek oracle. And one day, Echo, who was a nymph who was cursed by Hera for being able to repeat what other people said, and not going on too much of a tangent, I hope, but the reason that Hera cursed Echo was because she would engage Hera in long conversations while Zeus escaped from his cheating on Hera. And Hera found out eventually and cursed Echo to only be able to speak what others spoke to her. So Echo saw Narcissus and fell in love with him and chased after him. And when he would turn around and say, "Who's following me?" she could just say, "Who's following me?" and just repeat what he said. And finally, when he did turn around and see her, he spurned her. She went off and became nothing but an echo, and he was caught by his reflection in the water and turned into the flower. So we see that in these myths, they're all about being in love with oneself over another, whether it's a man or a woman, it just doesn't matter. It's the self that is the most beautiful and the most desired. And we also see how destructive that attention is, being unable to love others. It causes the others to die and disappear. And it also causes oneself to kind of fade away. The myth that I remember as a child was that he just was so captivated and standing there over his reflection that he just eventually turned into a flower. But most of what I read subsequently says that he committed suicide because he realized he would never find a love that was as perfect as his own reflection. So let me give you an example of a dilemma about narcissism in real life. A chief operating officer at a company was talking to me about his frustration with his CEO. Now, this man was very successful and ambitious and hardworking. But it was very important for him to get positive feedback and for others to recognize how helpful he was and how good he was at his job. And the CEO, on the other hand, liked to work on his own and pretty much kept himself and wanted everybody to kind of do their job separately. And this was very frustrating to the person that I was talking to. He felt like he was going beyond the constraints of his job. He was giving them ideas for new streams of income. He was even seeing where the CEO was missing things and trying to keep him on track. But the CEO just didn't really want his help and kind of kept it to himself. And this person was feeling very sensitive and was feeling rejected. And he became angry and wanted to leave. He kind of had an F you reaction, and he was going to go somewhere else or quit the job, which would not have been the best career move for him. And if we go back to the myth, we can see, A, he felt like he was being spurned, like Aminius or Echo. And like Narcissus, looking at his own reflection in the water, this man was looking for his reflection in the responses of all the people around him. So before I talk about how we use the concept of narcissism to help this executive deal with his CEO, I want to talk about the theory behind the concept of narcissism and the history of the theory. Now, Freud wrote an essay called On Narcissism, and in these ideas, he elaborated on his concepts of drives, which before that had been aggression and libido, what he called the id instincts. And in On Narcissism, he came up with the idea of the ego instincts. And the id instincts, he theorized, were in the service of the survival of the species, whereas the ego instincts, and this is where narcissism comes in, and he came up with the idea of primary narcissism, which is the instinct, and then secondary narcissism, which is something else. It's a defense that we develop later on. And the ego instincts are in the service of the survival of the individual. So we need both of them, but they are in conflict with one another. And speaking of Greek myths, the libido instincts, the sex drive, is Eros, which is another Greek myth, and Eros is intimately connected with Psyche. So we have all of these figures from Greek mythology all over these ideas of the mind. So like with most of the concepts that we talk about here on the Psychonauts show, Freud is really the first, the foundation, the beginning. And that's the case with narcissism. But it's later people who come along and really elaborate it into something that is more nuanced and has aspects of it that we can really use and think about. And the two people who probably are the most important in terms of thinking about narcissism are Heinz Kohut, who we met in the episode on optimal frustration and founder of the School of Self-Psychology, and Otto Kernberg in the Object Relations School. Now, we talked about Heinz Kohut. Otto Kernberg is actually one of these important historical theorists who actually is alive today. He's walking on the same ground that we are right now. He's well into his 90s, but he's still teaching, and he taught me back in my psychoanalytic training. And I remember him as a little bald guy with a heavy German accent. And I remember asking him about one of his ideas about aggression being fundamental, even on a single cellular level, and wanted to know more. And he told me to go read my book. That was the end of that conversation. But another anecdote I have is one of my colleagues decided to go to see Dr. Kernberg as his analyst, but Dr. Kernberg doesn't live in the city, he lives outside, so our colleague had to drive there and drive back and pay a very high fee, and he was complaining about it and saying, you know, how difficult it was. And another one of our colleagues asked him, so, well, why did you pick him? And he said, well, I wanted the best. And she said to him, ah, so it's not just masochistic, it's narcissistic and masochistic. So you can see the sort of nerdy little conversations and zings that psychoanalytic candidates like to lob at each other. But anyway, let's get back to Kohut and Kernberg. And they're often contrasted with one another in terms of their ideas about narcissism. And I'm going to try to be very brief about explaining the difference between them, but ultimately in clinical work, they're pretty similar. They overlap a lot and their ideas are both very useful, which is why I'm bringing them both in. But briefly, so Kohut's idea is that narcissism is a result of problems in development, problems of empathic failures that are not resolved. And he talks about this idea of the bipolar self, not bipolar like the diagnosis, but that we have poles of our self-esteem, very positive pole and a very negative pole. And when we have narcissism, we kind of swing back and forth between them too abruptly. And the remedy for this is to have a what he called a correct, well, actually it didn't begin with him. It began with what's known as the Budapest School, the Sandor Ferenczi and those guys. And hopefully I'm not being too nerdy at this moment, but I think it's important to give credit where credit is due. They were the ones that came up with the idea of the corrective emotional experience, but that's a big part of self-psychology, that later in life you can have a good experience, whether it's in analysis is the idea, but in life, and that makes you become a better person, not a narcissist, not anxious in this way. Whereas Kernberg says that narcissism is a defense mechanism against the split between all good and all bad. And you remember this from the Melanie Klein episode, where the paranoid schizoid position can't deal with the fact that there's bad things and they have to keep them separate. And that by going into the depressive position, they can resolve that. Well, the narcissistic person can't do that, but they use what Kernberg calls, and this is a great word, I think it's an awesome title, the pathologic grandiose self. It's like some kind of mythical monster that's lurking behind the mountains of the unconscious, the pathologic grandiose self. You can just see what that kind of angry monster is like. But that monster, that pathologic grandiose self, actually serves a purpose, which is preventing the person from feeling the terror of the good and the bad at war with one another. And so what the narcissist does is he puts all the good into himself, into this structure of the grandiose self, and then he's solved that problem. It's not a permanent solution like just entering the depressive position of maturity and realizing there's shades of gray in everything, but it is an attempt at a solution. And what Kernberg says, that it is repeated and relentless confrontation and tearing down of the pathologic grandiose self that leads to cure. And that's pretty dramatic and intense kind of idea, not this sort of organic growing that is more of the self-psychological idea. But in both, we can see that they're about an underlying insecurity about oneself and the world, and an anxiety that is so powerful that we have to put our sense of superiority into this kind of artificial structure, as per Kernberg, and say, this is the way things are, this is the way things are, and we can't let it go. A narcissist can't let it go, or the world will fall apart. And with Kohut, it's about always saying, am I good, am I good, am I good, putting all of the emphasis on me. Either way, they both help us understand why somebody might be preoccupied with themselves or always thinking that they're good, because something else underneath is the problem. So they help us. In both, empathy is key. So how did we use these different ideas about narcissism to think about this CEO who was kind of unresponsive and not interested in getting help? Well, first of all, this person had to realize how he was feeling, that he was feeling insecure, he was feeling not good about himself. He needed to reestablish his own sense of worth. This has to do with Kohut's idea of feeling not reflected, not good enough. And he needed to realize that he was looking to this CEO to do this for him. And that was his problem. He needed to wonder, why was he not feeling good about himself, and kind of reestablish his own worth. And this has to do kind of with the testament number three, the testament of birthright, is that we are all born good, and he needed to get back in touch with his goodness. It's what I call the reservoir of self-esteem. And the reservoir of self-esteem ultimately needs to be internal. There are external reservoirs of self-esteem, people who tell us that we're wonderful, or we can look at our achievements or things that we have done outside of ourselves that tell us that we are good. But ultimately, those things come and go, and we need to build up an internal reservoir of self-esteem. Once he knew what he was doing and needing the CEO to do, he was able to recognize that the CEO had his own insecurity and deal with him through that understanding. The CEO had his own narcissistic difficulties. Now, we weren't able to talk to this CEO about what was going on in him, so we couldn't really figure that out, but it was helpful to think this is something going on with him. Let me give you another example, though, of somebody who I did talk to who was sort of being accused of being a narcissist. And this was a man who was a filmmaker, and he had conflicts with his wife about his career and also just about how he kind of went about life. She was a very gregarious and extroverted person, very dedicated to social causes. She ran a nonprofit organization, whereas he spent a lot of time by himself thinking about different films, watching different films, and she thought he was self-preoccupied and told him so. Sometimes he would forget even things about her, like, you know, their anniversary or her birthday, or even just things that she told him. And she felt like he was being very selfish and self-centered. And she felt not only was he not thinking about her, but he didn't think about problems in the world and social justice that was very important to her. But what was actually going on was that, number one, he was in his imagination a great deal, and that was where his career came from, and a lot of richness in his inner life existed, and he poured into his work. But it was also a place that he went to because of bullying as a child. Imagination and play and writing and dreaming about things and creating scenes were what he did when he was a child, because he couldn't relate and couldn't have good relationships with other people in the social world. First of all, he needed to, again, connect with Testament number three and feel like he was basically good. He was not ultimately a self-centered, you know, uncaring person. And then he could explain this to her, not take it at face value that, you know, he wasn't good because he didn't do what she did, and explain to her that this was not only a result of his insecurity, but it was also that he did things differently and that the value that he brought into the world was just in a different way than she did. This would be more of a Cohutian kind of situation as we think about it. But let me give you another example of somebody who fits more into the Kernberg camp. Again, we can use these ideas to understand the situation and to think about this person and also for him to think about himself. This was a young man who had had a difficult childhood. He was very intelligent, probably too intelligent for the school that he went to, but he was always getting into trouble. He had much older parents who didn't really know what to do with him, and they took him to this therapist and that therapist and got him tested here and went to that school. And ultimately, they were advised to send him away to a boarding school on another coast as a teenager. And he was put on different medications, antipsychotics, mood stabilizers, antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, and he never really fit in. And ultimately, he ran away and got back home. He did get into college, but got into conflicts there and got kicked out. And he was having a really rough time. He was obviously not college educated. He couldn't really get more than sort of freelance part-time work, but he would always get into arguments with his bosses and coworkers and always feeling like this work is pointless and why does it have to be done, and just kind of complaining and thinking everything was stupid and bad. Everything from filling out a tax form to paying rent was just stupid. And really, all he needed to do was get a college education. He was very smart, loved to read, loved to write, but he had a math problem and he just didn't want to take remedial math so he could go to college. He refused to take it, said, "Who says I have to?" He would try, he would get angry, and he just could not move forward in his life because of this. Because why? It was so humiliating, and he couldn't let go of this structure of this grandiose self. I don't have to do this. The world is stupid. And, you know, the world had wronged him. It was true. But this was getting in the way of his own development. This defensive structure of his, this kind of narcissism, had actually allowed him to deal with a lot of stuff in his life. It had a purpose. It got him out of this terrible place that was putting him on medication. He got off medication. He didn't need any of it. But at a certain point in his adult life, he had to come to terms with what he didn't have, his inadequacies, so that he could remediate them and actually have a full life. So this is an example more of the Kernberg camp, where there's this defensive structure that has to be torn down, and it's very painful, but this has to go in order to move on in life. So I hope that you can see here that the psychoanalytic idea of narcissism and the different ideas that have been put forward about what it is, and even when they disagree with one another, like Kohut and Kernberg, that they're very useful in everyday life. It's not just about calling Donald Trump out or pointing fingers at people that you think are self-centered and calling people names, basically. It's useful to all of us, because what it really boils down to is just the management of self-esteem. And self-esteem is something that we all need. Again, it's testament number three. And as I was mentioning before, I think that self-esteem is a reservoir that we draw on. Now, yes, when things are happening that are nice, we don't need a reservoir of self-esteem. We just feel good. But when things aren't going our way, or when people are saying not nice things to us, then we need to have somewhere to draw on that makes us feel still like we're good. And as I said, there are external reservoirs of self-esteem, and there's an internal reservoir of self-esteem. External reservoirs for some people are their bank account. When they have a lot of money, they feel good about themselves, or the beautiful people that they might be with, or how good they feel about in their own body, how ripped they are, and are they down to 5% body fat with an 8-pack, and et cetera. That's a little bit narcissistic, but it's still an external reservoir of self-esteem. And insofar as it feeds our self-esteem, it's a good thing. The problem with the external reservoirs of self-esteem is they come and go. And again, this is back to the Buddhist idea of impermanence. Nothing is permanent. But if we have an internal reservoir of self-esteem, that's with us all the time, no matter what's going on outside, because we're always getting older. We're always losing things. You know, money comes and goes, people come and go, but an internal reservoir of self-esteem is under our control. But people always say, well, that makes a lot of sense, but how do I get that? You know, it's kind of a good question, and there's not really an easy answer to that, because the internal reservoir of self-esteem and external reservoirs of self-esteem are not completely different from one another. We actually build up our internal reservoir of self-esteem by drawing on positive things that happen to us in our experience and in our development and in the eyes of other people and in achievements that they have. But they have to become separate from that. They have to become part of us. And I want to give you an example of somebody who was able to achieve that. This is a man who came out as gay midlife, and he had achieved enormous success. He was in finance, but he had a wonderful marriage with a woman that he had met in college. They had a very good marriage, and even when they came out, obviously she was upset, and it really threw her world. They had 3 children together, but they were able to maintain a partnership. It was a good marriage, even as they were getting divorced. But with this divorce and his loss of his beautiful, perfect family, he realized how much of his self-esteem he had put on other things: having the perfect family, having the perfect job, driving the right car, having a beautiful home. And all of these things were very nice, but they were external reservoirs of self-esteem. And when they were taken away, he was left with this horrible feeling of shame and self-loathing that ultimately was related to his gay identity and what he had been told as a child growing up. But beyond his sexuality, it was necessary for him to reestablish himself as being the fountain, if you will, or where this comes, where the wonderful things that he had in the world had been created. He created them. And gradually, by self-reflection, by seeing what came and went, but what was there, which was his own goodness, positive relationships, his children, his intelligence, his ability to create things even as they were destroyed, that was the internal reservoir of self-esteem that he was ultimately able to consolidate and draw on going forward into the rest of his life. So what is the lesson here? Basically, narcissism is something that we have to deal with insecurity. There's primary narcissism, which is the ego instincts of Freud, which is just self-esteem, and that's what we're trying to manage. And then there are these other types of narcissism that are defenses, that are ways of managing anxiety. If you're a Cohutian, then you're more in touch with anxiety as a developmental insecurity, and somebody kind of needs to be understood and grow up. Whereas the Kernbergians tend to be more tough and aggressive, seeing narcissism as this malignant structure that needs to be torn down and keeps getting in the way of moving forward. But at the bottom line for all of it, it's a phenomenon, narcissism, that is covering over anxiety about oneself and one's value. Whether it's healthy or problematic is about how flexible and how easily we can acknowledge vulnerability. And that's really key, the ability to tolerate one's vulnerability, one's lack of perfection. We've talked about narcissism in pop culture, in business, in art, in all kinds of places in life. And now I'm going to bring in literature. One of the best portrayals of narcissism is in Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. And the narrator just basically is going on this long, depressing tirade about everything. And at one point he says this: "It is clear to me now that owing to my unbounded vanity and to the high standard I set for myself, I often looked at myself with furious discontent, which verged on loathing. And so I inwardly attributed the same feeling to everyone." That is a statement of a narcissist, if ever there was one. Spoken truly, I am so perfectionistic, I hate even myself and I hate everyone else too. That's the torture that is underlying this narcissistic experience. And the lesson is that it's basically what your mother always told you about bullies.
They act that way because they don't like themselves.
And the remedy is having an internal reservoir of self-esteem. We draw on external experiences that make us feel good, but ultimately we need that reservoir inside of us that we can draw on to remember our birthright of goodness, no matter what is happening in the world around us. This is Dr. JKB signing off. Since we are exploring together, you make the journey all the richer by subscribing to the show on iTunes. And even better, if you also leave a rating, it helps others to find us. If you have a story about how the concept in this episode helped you figure out something in your life, send it in, please. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter at Psychonaut Show. Show notes are on the website, thepsychonautshow.com. And if you leave me a question, it may well be an inspiration for an upcoming episode. Until our next trip, judge nothing, question everything, and remember, there's always a reason. Bye for now. All the patient stories presented on The Psychonaut Show are created by me to illustrate an idea. Any resemblance to actual people is purely coincidental. The Psychonaut Show was created and produced by yours truly, John Burton. Art and web design by Hunter Creative. Post-production and sound design by Julio Gonzalez of Zimmer Media. Zimmer Media can be found online at zimmer.co. That's Ximer.co.